If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
The NBA playoffs are here, and we all know playoff mode is a thing. Listen to the evidence. Playoff crowds are going wild. Playoff players are lighting up the court. Even your speakers are in playoff mode. Okay, we'll take it down a notch, but just a notch, because this is the turn it up to 11 NBA playoffs. Playoff mode is clearly a thing. The NBA playoffs presented by Google Pixel continue on ABC, ESPN, TNT, and NBA TV.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. A century ago, in the early years of Germany's Weimar Republic, the psychiatrist Hans Prinzhorn gathered and published a collection of artworks, all by psychiatric patients. These pieces had a profound impact on the art world and influenced many of the leading artists of the time. But within just a few years, both modernist art and people with mental illnesses found themselves in Hitler's firing line, with devastating consequences. In his new book, The Gallery of Miracles and Madness, the journalist and author Charlie English explores this multifaceted story. And for today's episode, he spoke to BBC History Magazine editor Rob Attar.
To begin with, could you please introduce us to the figure of Hans Prinzhorn? Who was he, and how did he come to be gathering artworks from people who were living in German asylums?
Sure. Well, Prinzhorn was a man of many talents, if you like. He was born in a kind of remote rural part of northern Germany, into a kind of quite rich bourgeois family, very well educated, according to the German system of the time. And he was unusual in having both a PhD in art history and having studied as a medical doctor. So by the start of 1919, just the end of the war, when he began collecting psychiatric art, he knew a lot about art, he knew also about medicine, and he was also a veteran of the First World War. So he was extremely, unusually well qualified, if you like, to explore this subject.
And what kind of people were producing this art, and what did Prinzhorn hope to achieve by gathering it and then showcasing it?
Well, the producers of this art spanned an enormous range of different people across a massively wide range of kind of professional ability, wealth, all kind of social strata, effectively. I mean, what joined them was that they were all the patients or inmates, if you like, to use the language of the time, within the German psychiatric institution. I mean, not a particular institution, but asylums all across Germany and indeed the German-speaking world. And some of them were even came from as far away as kind of the US or Japan. But they were all incarcerated, if you like, within the asylum system. Most of them were diagnosed with what was called schizophrenia. It had only just been described and defined as schizophrenia, but they had a severe mental illness. And yeah, so they'd been in for varying numbers of years. There were men and women, though there were more men in the collection than there are women, partly because of the way that art was defined really at that time. And so Prinzhorn's point, I guess, was to produce a very large volume of this work. And initially, in his conversations with the director of the Heidelberg Psychiatric Clinic, there was an intention that it might be used as diagnostic material. So there was a theory in psychiatry at the time that you could look at a particular work of art and draw conclusions about the nature of the illness that that particular person was suffering from. But Prinzhorn very quickly moved away from that. He didn't like the fact that people were being diagnosed on the basis of their art. And so he really became fascinated by it as art itself. I mean, he realized its power. He was interested in expressionism, which was very big in Germany at that time. And what you get from looking at this art is a very strong sense of its power to transport you and tell you something about the life or the existence or the inner life of the person who created it. And I think he recognized that really quite early on.
So for him, the art didn't necessarily reflect these people's conditions. It almost transcended it.
Yes, it transcended it. It had an amazing power to transport the viewer, I think is what he felt. It in a sense, gave you a window onto what these people were experiencing. And we're talking about a time when antipsychotic drugs hadn't been invented. So there was a lot of psychosis expressed in this art, or at least what Prinzhorn thought was psychosis. I mean, it's hard for us to actually tell because we don't really have the artist's full accounts of what exactly they were depicting. But certainly in many cases, they seem to be expressing something about the nature of their condition. And, there's no question that it's extremely powerful. I mean, these were very deeply felt sensations, I think, and you get some of that in looking at the art.
And it's fair to say, isn't it, that some of this art was of a really high quality. I mean, you see it, and that you've reproduced a number of the images in the book. This is really powerful, really creative stuff, isn't it? This art stands up against artists outside the asylum.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that's what astonished Prinzhorn, was that he thought this art was actually better in a way than some of the contemporary professional art that he was seeing at that time. And, you know, of course, there's the question of how do you judge art? What are the criteria for making good or bad art? And I think, you know, we have to remember that at this time, expressionism was, I suppose, at the cutting edge of avant-garde art. And part of the kind of way of judging expressionism was how powerfully it moved the viewer, and he was judging these works on that basis often. And he certainly felt that there was more authenticity and more power in some of his patient artwork than there was in the professional artist's material at that moment.
And what then was the response of the wider artistic community to the artworks when they discovered them?
Well, I think they were... I mean, there's obviously a kind of range of different reactions, but among the avant-garde particularly, and the more experimental end of it, they were kind of rapturous. I mean, they saw them and thought they showed great depths, great ways into the interior of the human world, the human condition. I mean, you've got to remember that we're talking about the time when art was looking more and more inside the artist, if you like. I mean, we'd come out of a kind of late 19th century tradition in which art was very representational. It was about trying to produce a very realistic version of what people saw. And after that, in the era of Freud, and particularly the First World War, art found a very different subject matter. I mean, the point was not to represent a kind of agreed version of reality. It was to try and show something about what lay inside people, what the human condition was, what the Freudian interior looked like. And so for professional artists who were trying to discover that interior world, the insane art, as it was called, seemed like a very genuine route into the interior. And so when Prinzhorn produced this kind of enormous wealth of material that seemed to almost exactly mirror what some of the avant-garde were doing at the time, everyone was pretty bowled over by it, really.
And then actually quite a few artists, even leading artists at the time, drew direct inspiration from some of their work.
Absolutely. I mean, Prinzhorn published a book in 1922, which was very richly, lavishly illustrated with work from his collection. And the book initially was sort of published in Germany, and the avant-garde in Germany lapped it up, if you like. It was circulated around the Bauhaus, where artists like Paul Klee looked at it and thought, you know, it was drew direct inspiration from it. And even art historians have gone through works in the collection and compared them with Klee's after the publication of this book and strong parallels. And then in 1922, in the summer of 1922, Max Ernst took the book from Germany to Paris, where he was joining the proto-surrealist movement around André Breton. And the book became such a valuable resource for the surrealists that it became known as the Surrealist Bible. And Breton and group around him were really obsessed with mental illness, and partly as a result of the First World War and their experiences in it, which of course were dramatic for a lot of artists, or a lot of people in Europe generally. And in the middle of the war, Dada had grown up, which was a kind of deliberately anti-rational attempt to react to the events of the First World War. And Breton and his friends saw madness as a sort of way of morally distancing themselves from the war itself. The idea was that rationality had caused the deaths of millions and millions of people and so much destruction, and that only through being mad could you attain some distance from these events. So they really almost worshipped mental illness. And so this book of largely schizophrenic art was a fantastic source book for them. And again, as with Klee, I mean, many of the surrealist artists directly borrowed from it and used the techniques of some of Prinzhorn's artists in their own work.
Do we know whether the artists themselves were aware of the impact their work was having in the wider community?
I think very few of them were. I mean, you've got to think that they were largely shut away from society. Many of them weren't even receiving visits from their family, never mind kind of getting newspaper articles or news from the wider world. Prinzhorn himself, after publishing his book, went on to different areas of psychology. He became very interested in psychotherapy, but didn't really pursue this area for long after the book. So, I mean, clearly some of the doctors were aware of the book and of Prinzhorn's work and in kind of elevating this type of material. But Prinzhorn also anonymized most of his artists, his schizophrenic masters, as he called some of them, and gave them pseudonyms because the theory at the time was that mental illness was such a kind of taint on a family that you wouldn't want a family name to be used in connection with a mentally ill patient because it might mean that your entire family were kind of shunned by the community. So he deliberately anonymized them. So there wasn't really any celebrity attached to the actual artists themselves.
Was there any backlash towards this book? Were there people within Germany and elsewhere who felt that this wasn't an appropriate thing to be doing?
Yes. I mean, it was a worry even when it was published. Even before it was published, there were certain members of the avant-garde even who were concerned that in connecting madness and art in this very kind of overt way, that this would produce some difficult political consequences, if you like. And, you know, again, we should think that at that time, artists were viewed as in many ways as sort of visionaries or seers for society. They were elevated to a very high level, and art itself was regarded, I think, probably more highly than it is today as a kind of noble philosophical enterprise. So for art and madness to be connected in that way, some conservative commentators particularly saw it as a sort of bringing low of art and almost a kind of Philistine attack on art, which of course it wasn't. I mean, it was a new territory, a new way of exploring interesting terrain. It wasn't really, there was no one was intending to bring art low as a result, but there were certain members of society and of course of the far right who viewed it in exactly that way.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
I think you have to recognise that he saw this as a sort of artistic project. And even people like Thomas Mann, who despised Hitler, wrote that you had to recognise that there was something of the artist in Hitler and in his politics.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
The NBA playoffs are here, and we all know playoff mode is a thing. Listen to the evidence. Playoff crowds are going wild. Playoff players are lighting up the court. Even your speakers are in playoff mode. Okay, we'll take it down a notch, but just a notch, because this is the Turn It Up to 11 NBA playoffs. Playoff mode is clearly a thing. The NBA playoffs presented by Google Pixel continue on ABC, ESPN, TNT, and NBA TV.
Now, coming on to the second part of your book, the figure who's introduced there is Adolf Hitler, who himself was an artist, certainly in his early life. How talented an artist was he, and how did he compare to other artists of the time?
Well, he certainly had an ability of some sort. I think it would be wrong to say that he didn't. Certainly when he was a schoolboy, he liked to draw. I think that's undisputed. And he showed some level of skill, which has been noted by various contemporaries from his childhood in Linz. He famously tried to get into the academy at Vienna. I mean, he thought he was a better artist than he was, and he thought it would be child's play for him to get into the Vienna Academy. So he applied and was absolutely flabbergasted when he failed. And I think even one of his great childhood friends, a man called August Kubitschek, noted that there was something about his art that was quite, he tended to be quite detailed, but it lacked a kind of artistic sensibility. It lacked a kind of sense of atmosphere or a capturing of emotion. What Hitler particularly liked to do was draw and paint buildings and architecture, which he did in a kind of detailed but slightly bland way. And it's clear that the academicians at Vienna didn't really see much potential for him as an artist because he didn't do any kind of portraiture. His figures are really quite poor. And they recommended he go into the building school and study architecture, but he hadn't got the exam results he needed to be an architect. So he was kind of doomed to fail. And after his rejection, he spent some years in Vienna and later in Munich selling watercolours to make a kind of fairly scratchy living, often copying them out from postcards of famous scenes around Vienna. And people would buy them. They weren't worth very much. Even in later life, he kind of said they were nothing. I just kind of did them to make a living. So, you know, he had a kind of moderate ability as a self-taught artist, but really nothing substantial.
And how much do you think this artistic frustration fed into his political career?
Well, I think it did. I mean, he was a very angry, frustrated individual even before this event. After it, he became worse. He was living with Kubizek in Vienna around this time. And bizarrely, he pretended to his friend that he had got into the academy. Kubizek came to Vienna to live with him and quickly got into the conservatoire. He was a musician and it was quite easy for him to get in to study music. But Hitler didn't get into the art school. So he would go out every morning and pretend he was going to art school and then come back, pretending he'd been there. I mean, it was a very strange situation and one that was almost designed to embarrass himself because it was obvious that someone, indeed Kubizek, was going to find out later on that he was lying. And Hitler would kind of come into their shared room, which was tiny and full of vermin, and rant about every aspect of the modern world and his life. So I think, you know, there's a kind of interesting Robert Harris style, you know, alternative history book, no doubt, to be written about what would have happened if Hitler had gotten into the Vienna Academy, and maybe things would have been very, very different. But it certainly fueled his resentment towards the world, which was really what the source of his politics was.
But even when he rose in his political career, is it fair to say he still saw himself as an artist to some extent?
Yes, I mean, I think you could say, as people have, that Nazism, to an extent, was an artistic project. I mean, he always saw himself as an artist in later life. Even in the First World War, before he went into politics, he was known in his regiment as the artist. And in later life, his propaganda made him out to be a kind of artist genius, the artist Führer, the artist in chief. And the way that Nazism worked, that the pageants, the stage sets, even the speeches, there was a sort of artistic quality to them. He designed various Nazi logos and uniforms himself, famously. He oversaw the creation by people like Albert Speer of the light shows and propaganda rallies and the marching men, which in cells, they were a sort of pageantry, a sort of artistic event. And then, I mean, you can even argue that his great artistic work, as he saw it, though of course it was also his most horrific and genocidal policy, was a sort of resculpting of the German people. And he wanted to use eugenics as a way of reshaping the Aryan Germans, as he saw them, into a kind of Übermensch, which meant the eradication of a whole bunch of other people. So yes, I mean, I think you have to recognize that he saw this as a sort of artistic project. And even people like Thomas Mann, who despised Hitler, wrote that you had to recognize that there was something of the artist in Hitler and in his politics.
And I suppose following on from that, the Nazis had very strong views themselves on art, and this would have quite negative consequences for many of the artists you talk about early in your book.
Absolutely. I mean, Hitler was an anti-modernist in artistic terms of the most extreme kind. When we talk about the conservative right rejecting Prinzhorn's ideas about insanity and its connections with expressionism and with modern art, I mean, Hitler was a kind of arch conservative in that respect. So he detested the idea that artists should be exploring an inner world, or that Dada should exist at all. I mean, he called it the excrescences of insane and degenerate men, you know. So he personally disliked modern art enormously. And then I think he must have seen it as a way to bring the man or woman in the street over to Nazism. I mean, it's said that he used it as a sort of bridge to his politics, because I think you could say, like today, a lot of the general population wasn't particularly keen on avant-garde art. Then, as now, people would kind of judge it as kind of ridiculous and say, well, any idiot could do that kind of thing. And so by attacking modernism, by attacking the avant-garde, Hitler was finding common cause, if you like, with some of the German, a section of the German electorate. And these degenerate art shows, which is what the Nazis ended up staging to shame modern art, were extremely popular. I mean, millions of people went to see these events. And of course, the Nazis promoted them very heavily, and they bussed and laid on trains to get people to them. But there was a certain chord that the politics was striking with the population at the time.
Actually, interestingly, in your book, you show that Prinzhorn himself was not always as anti-Nazi as you would presume him to be.
That's right. I mean, he, in the early 1930s, wrote a series of articles where he appears to sympathise with Nazism, or even say that Hitler is a good thing. And there was a section of the kind of German intellectual elite at that point who were extremely worried about the future of Germany. You're coming out of the Great Depression after the Wall Street crash. Germany has gone through a period of starvation after the First World War. I think something like 6 million people are unemployed in the early 1930s. And there is a real angst among many German intellectuals that Germany needs a kind of rebirth. And the strong man comes along like Hitler and appears to rally people, bring them together, and promise a kind of glorious future. And Prinzhorn, who was politically quite a naive man, seems to have got sucked into that to an extent. I mean, I think it's hard to say what he would have thought about what happened later in the 1930s or even the 1940s, but because he died in 1933. But I think he would probably have been horrified by what happened later on, because it ran completely counter to all his cultural leanings in the 1920s. But he did have this unfortunate period of, in a sense, supporting Hitler.
And of course, the Third Reich was particularly dangerous for people with psychiatric illnesses. Could you just explain what the Nazis' attitude was to the kind of people who were producing the art Prinzhorn showcased?
Well, even in the mid-1920s and early 1920s, Hitler showed a tendency to want to get rid of the mentally ill. And this was something that, again, had come out of the First World War, when Germany had been in such terrible straits and hundreds of thousands of people had literally starved to death. Many people in psychiatric institutions had starved to death because there wasn't enough food to go around, and the food was prioritised, and people believed it should go to the people who were fighting at the front and so on. So a lot of psychiatric patients starved in that period. And this almost legitimised, in a way, the idea that the mentally ill were somehow unworthy of life, or that when it came, when push came to shove and there wasn't enough food to go around, these were the people who would have to suffer. So in Mein Kampf, in the mid-1920s, Hitler states fairly clearly that really tough decisions need to be made regarding people who aren't of entire full value to the German Reich. And as time goes on, it becomes more and more clear what this really means, which is initially a program of sterilization, which is introduced very soon after Hitler comes to power in 1933, and hundreds of thousands of psychiatric patients are forcibly sterilized in Germany. And then after that, you get to the period of involuntary euthanasia, which is essentially the first Nazi mass murder action. And so, as far as I'm aware, the first industrialized killing by a state of its own population that's happened anywhere in history.
And do we know roughly how many people were killed by the Nazis in this way?
Something in the region of, I'm going to say, about 300,000. The first action, which was called Action T4, which was a gassing action, killed about 70,000 people. And this was a system that the Nazis built, that Hitler's private office designed, which used carbon monoxide gas to pump into gas chambers, prototype gas chambers, and the mentally ill were shipped to these specific killing stations, which were stationed all around the Reich. And they were bused there and told that they were going to a new institution, that they were going to a hospital of some sort or a psychiatric hospital of some sort. And then they were taken into these places. And then that very same day, in almost all cases, stripped and forcibly pushed into these, the first one was like a converted coach house, pushed in to a chamber that had been designed to look like a shower room. The doors were locked and then the gas was turned on and they were killed in their dozens. And then their bodies were dragged out and then they were put into burning ovens and incinerated. And this began in 1940, and something like 70,000 psychiatric patients were killed in that process, which was obviously the prototype for the actual Holocaust, which was to come later. And in fact, many of the same SS employees who were employed in Action T4 were taken on to the camps in Poland to kill Jews later on. So, but Action T4 probably killed about 70,000 people. And then after that, there was a period of what they called wild euthanasia or decentralized euthanasia, when institutions were encouraged to kill patients in a less formalized way, because the Nazis realized that the population were getting wind of what had gone on, and they didn't want it to be so structured.
So was there then much opposition to this program among the wider German population?
There doesn't seem to have been. I mean, not at the time. One of the main characters in my book is an artist called Franz Karl Bühler, who was killed in an institution called Grafeneck, which was really the first killing station at about 30 miles outside Stuttgart in a castle there. And I went to Grafeneck and kind of looked around the site, and it's quite a rural area, and it's a kind of leafy green valley, and the castle stands at the top of this valley on a kind of artificial promontory, and there are a few small towns and villages around. But, you know, I guess people say after these events, after the downfall of Hitler, that they didn't know anything about it, but the chimneys went night and day pouring out this atrocious smelling smoke, which stuck to people's houses and covered them with soot. And of course, the SS killers drank in the bars down the road, and they bought at the shops and their vehicles were fixed by the mechanics and the garages and so on. So a lot of the local people did reasonably well out of the killing station being there. And there were very few protests from people in the local area. There were even quite few protests from the psychiatry profession, who many of whom actually agreed with the action, and not too many heads of psychiatric institutions at that point protested very strongly against what was happening. Those who did, of course, were often punished either by being sacked and replaced by a kind of party member, or in a very few cases sent to concentration camps themselves, but that was really very infrequent. And I think probably the greatest resistance came from certain members of the church. But even then, it wasn't really very strong. And certainly the program achieved its target of killing 70,000 people before protesters stopped it. I mean, it ended because it had reached 70,000, which was a preset number, not because of the resistance to it.
I was interested in something you said just earlier about how some members of the profession actually welcomed the mass murder of psychiatric patients. Well, what was the rationale behind that?
Well, it was, in the aftermath of the First World War, there were two intellectuals, if you like, who came up with this idea of life unworthy of life, which was people who were so mentally ill or their condition was so bad that they were not able to enjoy life. They were a burden on the state, and they weren't worthy of living. The two people who wrote this little pamphlet, one of them was a lawyer, and the other one was a psychiatrist. So there was a drive from within the psychiatric profession itself that some of the patients would be better off if they were euthanized. And this debate within the profession rolled on through the 20s and into the early 30s. And it wasn't adopted in the mainstream at that point. But of course, when the Nazis came to power, the debate was still being had, and there were still psychiatrists in the profession who had supported that idea. And of course, the right-leaning, the more extremist, far-right aspects, members of the profession, were more likely to be the ones who were arguing for mass murder or involuntary euthanasia. So, yeah, there was certainly a large section of the psychiatric profession at that time who didn't really object or who even approved of it.
And presumably, the artists that appeared in Prinzhorn and your book, I presume they all died during the war?
Not all of them. I mean, some of them had died beforehand. Of course,
sure.
Prinzhorn was collecting in 1919 to 1921, mostly. So by 1940, some of them were very old. Some of them were already dead. Some of them did survive Hitler and the war, but something like 30 or so were killed by the Nazi euthanasia actions, including the guy who Prinzhorn thought was his best discovery, Bühler, who's also the kind of hero of the book. So certainly it wasn't the majority of them that were killed by the Nazis, but a substantial minority were.
And clearly your book ends on quite a bleak note with the mass killings under the Third Reich, but are there any positive legacies of the story you tell beyond the artworks themselves?
Absolutely, yeah. I try not to end on a bleak note. I mean, there is a very bleak note near the end. But the aftermath of Prinzhorn's collection is, I think, a very positive story. And partly it's that Prinzhorn's collection itself survived the war, despite being used in the degenerate art shows as comparative material to show that modern art and Prinzhorn's material were very similar, and to defame modern art. The Prinzhorn collection survives and is rediscovered really in the 50s and 60s. And one of the people who comes to see it in the late 1950s is Jean de Buffet, who is a French artist who saw Prinzhorn's book when he was a young man in the 1920s and became absolutely fascinated with it. And after the war, launched his own collection of psychiatric art, because he wanted to escape the idea that there was a kind of educated elite who were able to produce art. He thought art should be democratized. And his idea was that to produce a kind of raw art, as he called it, or art brut. And so he looked into psychiatric art and collected it widely, and it informed his own artwork. And he took his collection around Europe and to New York even for some time, where it was seen by the abstract expressionists and many of the great American post-war artists. And in the kind of 1970s, this kind of art, this art that wasn't produced by professionals, was given a name by a British art critic who described it as outsider art. And this notion of outsider art, or art that is produced by people who aren't trained, has really gathered a lot of momentum since then. And there is an annual outsider art fair and a kind of wide acceptance that outsider art is just as valid as professional art, if you like. And that you know, the range of art makers is much broader than people initially thought.
That was Charlie English. The Gallery of Miracles and Madness, Insanity, Art and Hitler's First Mass Murder Programme is out now, published by William Collins. You can find a link in the show notes. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Ben Hewitt, Jack Bateman and Brushney Colley. Join us tomorrow when Clive Aslett will be speaking about the history of the country house.